Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. A quick reminder that we take our show on the road about a half a mile away, as it turns out here, for tomorrow night's home football opener, the season football opener for Michigan State University. We're going to be visiting with John Madden of the Spartan Marching Band, and Al Martin of Current Sports and I will share the hour between 6 and 7 o'clock tomorrow night, so we are looking forward to that. Well, the bad news is August is disappearing. The good news is Labor Day weekend is almost here, and with the end of the month, we take some time to review the month's most impactful Michigan news stories. We welcome this month's panel, the host of WKAR-TV's Off the Record, Tim Skubick. Tim,
hey,
how are you?
Good, buddy. How you doing?
Good. Zach Gorchow is the editor for Gongwer News based in Lansing. Hi, Zach.
Good morning.
And Kathleen Gray covers the state capitol for the Detroit Free Press. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Mark.
With quite a bit of drama, the Michigan Senate on Wednesday evening approved the expansion of Medicaid. Let's revisit part of Governor Snyder's comments afterward.
This is not generic Medicaid expansion. This is a Michigan version that talks about personal responsibility, that talks about wellness. We have one of the best managed plan histories for Medicaid in the country, and we should be proud of that, and we can continue on that path. So in many respects, this is a win for all of us.
Meanwhile, repercussions from the Medicaid expansion vote continue. First of all, when will the expansion take effect? About April 1st or the 1st of 2014? Further Senate action is required for the earlier start date. Tim Skubick, where are we today?
I think we're going to see a vote next week in the Senate to give it immediate effect. The governor fell 2 votes short. The number is 26. They got 24. I think you have to put that vote on Wednesday night in the context of the emotions that were so raw on the floor. I think some Republicans just said, I'm not going to do this for the governor. But, you know, you give them the week. They have some fun over the Labor Day. They get rained on Monday like we always do on Labor Day, and they come back, and I think that he gets the votes sometime next week.
Boy, one vote was pretty hard to come by, though, the night before last, and we need 2 more this time?
He needs to get to 26.
Yeah.
And he had 24. I think that's doable.
Okay.
You have to remember, immediate effect tends to be more of a procedural type vote, and the general mentality has always been that if you voted against the bill itself and you lost on the issue, that to vote against immediate effect in a lot of cases is sour grapes. I mean, what are you really accomplishing here? And we had talked to at least one senator yesterday who had said basically just what Tim did, that everybody was really worked up. He had voted against the bill, and everybody was worked up, and he was one of those who voted against immediate effect. But he thought next week that things might change, and the votes would be there to do it.
Well, and they have to take this vote in the context of the lost money that's going to happen, $7 million a day that the state will lose from the federal government if they don't take effect on January 1st. Plus, individuals are going to be left with having to pay penalties if they're not able to sign up for Medicaid and have insurance for those times, because the penalties kick in on January 1.
And they will also continue to take a beating at the hands of the Democrats, who will use this as an issue of lack of leadership, quote-unquote, on the governor's part and the Republicans' part. Here's all these people that are uninsured, and they need to be insured, and the Republicans couldn't get their act together. So there's a political downside to not doing this as well.
But is Senator Richardville, he still plays a pretty critical role here in getting all the votes? He's in the driver's seat, the catbird seat, if you prefer.
This is his call. They haven't decided exactly what they're going to do, but they did hold on to the bill in the Senate as opposed to transmitting it to the House for the concurrence vote. So it's pretty clear they're talking about how to get immediate effect. And in general, the Senate Republicans have had a policy this year where immediate effect is considered a vote where they stick together on. So it would seem like they can get at least 2 of these 14 Republicans who voted no to do it.
Speaker Jace Bolger has said he expects to pass another version of Medicaid expansion in the House on the first day of the new session next week. Is it going to be as uneventful as that in the House, Kathy?
Maybe not. I think that there certainly is some buzz out there that Tea Party folks are going to come and try to get House members to come and change their minds. But I don't think I don't think that the result is going to be any different. The vote count might be a little bit different, but I think it'll still pass.
Just to be clear, it's the same version of what the Senate sent over. I don't think they're going to delve back into the bowels of this thing and make any substantive changes. And for this to fail in the Senate, 24 people would have to say, I got it wrong the first time. I voted yes. Now I'm going to vote no. That's a boatload of folks.
Let's transition a little bit. Wes Nakagiri of the group Retake Our Lieutenant Gov, or I'm sorry, Retake Our Gov, announced his intention to run for Lieutenant Governor against Brian Kelly to provide the administration with more of a Tea Party viewpoint on policy. Let's listen to a little bit of his reasoning as he shared it with Tim Skubick here on WKAR-TV's Off the Record.
Think about it, the average voter, the less informed voter, they're going to be looking at the top of the ticket, Snyder versus whoever. The informed voter, the people that are in the trenches, are going to be looking at the top of the ticket, but they're also going to be looking at the lieutenant governor. They'll see something they like in the lieutenant governor, and it's going to get them out to vote.
This leads to the question, especially in the aftermath of the Medicaid vote, how mobilized, how motivated with regard to next year's election are Michigan's Tea Party Republicans right now?
I mean, right now it's a 10 on a scale of 10. I mean, there is major anger being vented from Tea Party activists toward the members of the legislature, especially those senators who voted yes on Medicaid expansion, and they really see Lieutenant Governor Kelly as their best opportunity to claim a pound of flesh, because thus far the Tea Party hasn't been terribly successful in winning, getting their candidates elected in actual elections. There's Lieutenant Governor would be chosen at the state Republican convention next year, and the Tea Party has been very successful at that.
And you also have just reported, Zach, on Senator Patrick Kolbeck and his apparent desire to run for Speaker of the House as well.
Senate Majority Leader.
Majority Leader.
That's correct. He has led the fight against this in the Senate, and he's not happy about it going down to defeat. He's going to run for leader next year.
You spoke with him on this?
Yes. Yeah, I talked to him yesterday. He really did everything he could to try to defeat the legislation, to the point of even not voting so that there wouldn't be a tie vote allowing Lieutenant Governor Kelly to break that tie and vote yes. And he's really disappointed with the current Senate Republican leadership. I think it's an uphill fight for him. There's other people looking at it. But it'll be interesting to have him in the mix running for leader.
Do we know how the governor responds to all of this ferment?
Well, the governor prides himself on not being a politician. And he said on Tuesday night afterwards that, he's very, very passionate about this issue, and made some comments when the Senate didn't act in June that really hacked off the Senate Republicans. And I think he's trying to mend some fences, says that he didn't take any offense to or he didn't mean to offend people. But the governor realizes that this is a very divisive issue and is going to go forward with it.
And Tim, what did you take away from Wes Nakagiri's appearance on Off the Record?
Did
He's
have,
pretty intent on this.
I have an automatic 10 columns to get me through the next step. I'm going to a very self-serving story, you know what I'm saying? It's a fascinating dynamic. It really is. The governor would say, this is part of democracy. This is good, you know. But behind the scenes, they've got to be saying, wow, I think we've got a problem here. This is not only about Mr. Kelly. This is about Mr. Snyder. I mean, if he can't hold the Tea Party or get some inroads into the Tea Party base of his party, I got the same thing in your throat that you do, Zach, excuse me. He could be politically in trouble. This is a huge plus for the Democrats. Anytime you're running against an incumbent and you can see a divided party sitting out there, you're going, yeah, that looks pretty good. So how the governor handles this will have a good deal to say how well he does in the election. Today, is Kelly off the ticket? No. But this is not held today. There's a lot of water to go over the dam before they get to a party convention. And as Zach suggested, correctly so, it's a numbers game. If the Tea Party folks show up with more numbers than the governor, Mr. Kelly could be in deep doo-doo. If the governor gets into the game and makes sure he gets his delegates to the convention, everything will be hunky-dory. But it's a question mark, a huge one at this read.
It was Tea Party Republican Month on Off the Record, too. Nakagiri wasn't the only conservative Republican you had on the show. It was very interesting.
Todd Cursor has announced he may want to, may want to run for lieutenant governor. And so it this is, as they said, Alice said, it's getting curiouser and curiouser.
Unionized state employees were handed a setback 2 weeks ago in a 2-1 ruling by the Michigan Court of Appeals. Kathy, can you remind us briefly what the court was looking at there?
Well, there are about 36,000 state employees who are covered by union contracts. And a coalition of those unions got together and filed a lawsuit against the right to work law, saying that the Civil Service Commission is the one who handles their work rules, not and they should not be subject to the right to work law. The Court of Appeals disagreed. And just this week, the unions said that they're going to go to the Supreme Court, appeal that ruling and go to the Supreme Court to try to get it so they're not subject to the right to work law.
You reported at the time that Ken Moore, president of the Michigan State Employees Association, believes the ruling will not stand at the Supreme Court level.
Well, the Supreme Court has got a 5-2 Republican majority, and I think it probably will stand.
How likely is that? How is it likely to play out there? Then, probably not. Mr. Moore's optimism is not justified.
Right. I think the Supreme Court will side with the Court of Appeals.
Any other thoughts?
Well, this is all about collecting dues, okay?
Yes.
This is what this is, okay? And the unions contend that their power, political power, will be undercut. So we'll take it to a lot of people are confused. This was not a ruling on the legality of right to work. That still is pending somewhere.
It's on who's impacted by right to work.
Well, if you talk to the unions, obviously they are.
Yeah.
The big question here is how many state employees will opt out if, presuming the Supreme Court upholds this, how many will decide not to continue on in their union, and what is the impact there, and how does that affect the state employee workforce?
Do we know how that's playing out in other states? Is it significant, the number of union members not paying dues in the other 23 right-to-work states?
You know, it's hard to get a read on it because a lot of them are private unions. They don't necessarily have to report all of this. It really varies depending on the type of employee from what we hear, that if it's public safety workers maybe tend to be more likely to stay in their union, whereas take like grocery store workers that tend to be a little bit more transitory, may not necessarily be there 10, 20, 30 years. That, you know, if you're only there a couple of years, you're less likely to be in there. That's the general thinking.
Congressman Dave Camp's flirtation with the U.S. Senate run from Michigan next year was extremely short-lived earlier this month. What do you make of that, Kathy?
Well, I think Republicans know that to win a statewide race is difficult in Michigan, that Democrats have had better luck winning statewide races. Dave Camp has got a great position in Congress. He's in a very, very safe district, and I think that he can probably have that seat in Congress for as long as he wants. If he decides to go for a Senate seat, it's a much bigger risk. So he joins Mike Rogers, who declined to run. Candace Miller declined to run. Most other people are declining to run on this, too.
Well, this mainstream Republicans seem unable to persuade, this doesn't have a whole lot of appeal for some number of mainstream Republicans.
Well, I was looking in the Dave Camp story for another angle as to what the reason was, and I couldn't find one, other than he wanted to work on tax reform as chairperson of the House Ways and Means Committee. He's going to be term limited out of that post, and I think he's thinking long-term legacy. And I think he concluded, as one source told me, that he thought he could have a greater impact on American lives by working on that than going and being 100 guys in the U.S. Senate, and I think his analysis is correct, if they can pull it off. Now, he may not be able to do it, but I was surprised that he said it as quickly as he did, but nothing else nefariously going on there. He would have been the automatic front runner, and now he's just going to watch.
It's the same kind of thought process Mike Rogers went through, was it not?
To a degree.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's just, you've got a pretty good gig as it stands already. And what kind of impact does this have on the candidacy of the Tea Party-friendly Terry Lynn Land? Where does that leave her?
Well, she's another in the driver's seat.
Mainstream Republican not deciding to pursue this.
I mean, I would still put Terry Lindland historically in the mainstream of the party. I mean, she has reached out to the Tea Party, but I would not consider her a quote-unquote Tea Party favorite necessarily, though she is making some inroads there. But she's in the driver's seat now. You know, she's won two statewide elections. She's polling pretty well. And there's nobody else in there. So, you know, given all of that, I think, you know, she's in a pretty good spot. Though there is still these machinations going on behind the scenes in the Republican Party to find somebody else. If there's still this sort of lack of confidence about whether Terry Lindland can bring it home.
And there is some movement. You didn't have a whole lot of people endorsing Terry Lindland's candidacy, but all of a sudden that's starting to happen. Candace Miller came out in favor of her. Pete Hoekstra endorsed her this week. So I can't say it's momentum, but at least it's some movement.
Well, maybe people were waiting on Mike Rogers. They were waiting on Dave Camp, possibly that kind of thing. They're out now, so now it's more endorsements.
Well, I think it was kind of interesting that both Camp and Rogers, when they decided not to run, didn't say, and we think Terry Lindland would be a great senator.
Yeah.
So I think that is at least worth mentioning.
There's still some wait and see going on out there. It is pretty early. Also this month, Ingham County Judge Rose Marie Aquilina, functioning as a one-person grand jury, ruled that Michigan House Speaker Jace Bolger and former state rep Roy Schmidt were not subject to prosecution for their primary election caper last year in West Michigan. Our listeners will remember that Jace Bolger conspired with the Democrat Schmidt last year on a last-minute party switch and lined up a bogus Democrat before the scheme became known. Here is a bit of Speaker Bolger on WMUK Kalamazoo after the ruling.
Roy Schmidt switching parties was not a mistake. I would do that again. We took it one step too far in worrying about his opponent. And it wasn't to win. It was to protect him, if you will. The reason for that is we didn't believe we were going to beat Roy when he was a Democrat. He'd been elected for 20 years. We were worried about what the Democrats would do to destroy him because he switched parties. But once again, the mistake is to focus on the competition or to focus on winning instead of focusing on doing what's right for voters and letting voters make that decision.
There seems to be a broad consensus that this was truly creepy, but in the end, not illegal. What's the takeaway from this?
Well, you know, there's nothing creepy about trying to win an election through a nefarious way. I mean, this is not unique to Mr. Bolger, is it, guys?
No, not at all. This type of thing happens all the time when you get somebody who gets an opponent that has the same last name as the candidate.
How about Mike Duggan?
Why?
Right.
Why did this rise to that level?
The guy's the Speaker of the House.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And they got caught. Okay. A lot of this stuff goes on sub rosa that we never find out in the press corps.
But you're maintaining it's not that creepy.
To the Speaker's credit, he admitted they made a mistake. Okay. They tried to do something that if he had to do it over again, he wouldn't do to try to protect him, to use his language. But to the grand juror, I think the thing that puzzled Ollie, she took almost a year and came up with a goose egg. So obviously she concluded there was nothing there. Now, she didn't rule on the political efficacy of this. She had to rule on the law, and obviously no criminal laws were broken in her mind, and that's the ruling.
Yeah, I mean, I think there were so many things that edged this up into the stratosphere, into a big story. You had Roy Schmidt getting caught in a lie when he said, you know, shortly after he switched parties that he had never met the fake candidate. Turned out that was a lie. He had met with him the day that the filing for office was taking place, and that lie was caught on camera. You had the Republican prosecutor in Kent County issue this scorching report, just castigating both the Speaker and former state representative Schmidt. Between those two, and the fact that it was the Speaker, like Tim said, this wasn't some random city council somewhere. You add all that together, and that's why this became such a big deal.
Is this a starting point for any kind of reform? Or is it, in the end, is it so much business as usual that we shouldn't expect anything?
Well, last year, after this, it's sort of a damage control move, but it seemed pretty sensible. The House passed some bills that would have been designed to prevent a similar situation where You have a candidate withdraw, you know, the last day or the last couple days before the deadline to file, and leaving its party with nobody. It basically would have allowed the party that had gotten shafted a chance to find somebody new after the deadline. That passed the House but never went anywhere, and I don't think it's been, you know, there's been no sign of action on it this year.
Yeah, I don't think anything will happen from it. Like I said earlier, this type of thing happens on a pretty regular basis, recruiting fake candidates, things like that, and it just, I think it's going to be the same.
And Michigan's road funding debate appears likely to continue into next year. GOP Senate Majority Leader Richard Vill implied that this month when he alluded to real structural problems with the way we fund things today. That's a quote. Zach, can you explain the latest sales tax idea here to raise road repair funding?
Yeah, it's a little bit complicated, so stay with me here on this. But the general idea would be to take the 6% sales tax that we pay on all goods now, including fuel, off of fuel. That's about $1 billion that you'd be taking away. But then what you would do is you would raise the current gasoline tax in one form or another. Maybe you knock up the percents. We pay 19 cents per gallon now. Maybe you knock it up to 30, 35, 40 cents per gallon, so that essentially you are paying the same amount at the pump now that you are, but all of the money is going to roads. The current sales tax does not go to roads. It goes to schools, local governments, the state's general fund. So the idea being, if you're a motorist at the pump, you know that every cent of taxes you're paying is going to roads. Now that creates a problem because you're taking money away from schools and local governments. So to make that whole would mean raising the sales tax to 7%. So that they don't lose money. That's been the general parameter of what's been discussed, but I have to say right now, the issue just seems dead in the water, especially coming off of this controversial Medicaid vote where so much political capital was expended.
What he said, he's got it nailed.
Yeah.
I see no momentum building for this at all. Each passing day moves us closer to the election cycle next year. Politicians, I think they've done internal polling data, and people basically say, yeah, the roads are bad, but tax the other guy. I don't want to pay for it, which brought the governor in a town hall meeting the other night. I thought it was kind of interesting, sort of pleading with people to say, please say that you're willing to help me on the roads thing, and the silence was deafening. I think this is in trouble.
But that's a great point. I just want to add what Tim said at this town hall meeting in Grand Rapids. The governor, for the first time, really showed some lack of confidence when he said people may not, this may not be important enough to them.
Zach Gorchow, editor for Gongwer News, Tim Skubick of WKAR-TV's Off the Record, Kathy Gray of the Free Press. Many thanks to all of you.
Likewise.
It's Current State on WKAR. For over 30 years, a unique troupe of American improv performers has taken to stages across America and around the world to bring the art of improvisational comedy into the school classroom. Wavelength is a Chicago-based musical comedy ensemble that performs for teachers and school administrators. Their carefully crafted routines address relevant issues in education, often irreverently. Here's a taste of the group's latest presentation, Uncommon Core.
You got a master's degree in education, but the standards want to make you go on vacation. You got skills to the gills and a dope IQ, but with Common Core standards, you just don't know what to do. You can hate all you want, but you can't prevent it. Gotta learn about it, gotta implement it. You can diss the standards, but you can't resist them.
Wavelength holds a training today here in Lansing. They're appearing for the Lansing School District's Professional Development Day gathering. And the group's founder, Jim Winters, began our conversation by breaking down the elements of their internationally known program.
We've got an hour-long keynote program, and that's the comedy, the humor, the improv, the scripted pieces. And then often we stick around and we do training workshops with teachers, showing them how to use improv in their classrooms, running a communications workshop for the teachers to show them how to build their communication skills. But we do that by getting them to interact with improvisational structures and exercises that we've often used in the past as a means of honing our improv skills, our creativity, even getting us to scenic material. But the exercises are really great for getting people to communicate better.
And some number of members in Wavelength are former teachers like yourself. How many?
Well, actually, just myself, in terms of having classroom experience, we've got a couple of people that serve as what they call these days teaching artists, where they work for a theater group in Chicago in an outreach program, and they go out into classrooms and use theater as a means of teaching students. But I was the only one that actually had public and private school classroom experience teaching kids.
Was there an aha moment when you came on to this idea for Wavelength?
There was a buddy and I. He was in the corporate arena. I was in teaching. We were taking the workshops together at Second City, and we were very taken with the process and the excitement that builds when you get up on that stage and you start to improvise. And we thought, what are other applications of this? Turned out I had worked with his wife. She'd been the librarian at a high school where I taught English. And he said, Kath is on the, what we called back then, the in-service day committee. They now call it professional development, professional training. He said she could get us a gig in front of the teachers if we focused this improv and our humorous perspectives on education. So we both were like, whoa, that would be pretty awesome. So we started then to devise a program that we could present to the teachers at the high school I had just left. And so the idea was terrific. And when we stepped on stage, we based a lot of our material on sort of my foibles as a beginning teacher. And I was a little embarrassed to go out there and share with them some of the silly things I had done. But the sillier the thing that I shared, the higher the laughs got. It was just quite amazing to realize, oh my gosh, we're sort of all in this together, yet we close our doors and have an individual experience. When we put it out there for a group, the laughter of recognition goes off the charts. So we're all struggling like this. Let's bring this out in the open and get some perspective around it.
Do you think teachers generally acknowledge that there's some degree of performance involved in teaching?
I think so, and it's become a greater program in the literature. There are people talking about, the 49 performance techniques that teachers need to know, from vocal inflection to eye contact to, how to be engaging with your students and body movement. So there are people that train them just like stage actors. And I think when we make the case, in fact, we open the show saying, we're going to be improvising today. We want to get you connected. How many of you have seen improvisation? Quite a few hands go up. And I say, how many of you have performed improvisationally? A few hands go up, and I say, I should see every person's hand up. You guys are all teachers, right? And then they sort of like chagrin go, oh, yeah, you're right. We're always in the moment, often off script because of the nature of education. It's hard to stay on a particular plan or a target, and all sorts of exigencies hit you in the moment, and you need to play at the top of your intelligence, and those are a lot of the basic tenets of improv. So I think they see not only are they actors, but they're working without a script, so they're improv actors.
I know a lot of Wavelength's appearances are in the Midwest, but you have appeared even outside the country. Tell us about that.
We've been fortunate enough. We got to the Netherlands to do some work as an ensemble. And then I run a workshop for teachers called The Sense of Humor, where I talk to teachers about the importance of humor, laughter, and improv, not only in the classroom, but in their collegial relationships. And that got pulled out, and I was able to go to The Hague in the Netherlands. I got to Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam. We're in the Philippines.
And I understand your appearance in The Hague involved a member of royalty, too. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I was asked for the European Council of International Schools to help them celebrate their 25th anniversary. They asked me to summarize the three speakers ahead of me and then give a little shout-out to the organization. Turned out They had a guy from the World Bank, somebody from the European Space Agency, Prince Edward, the fourth son of Queen Elizabeth, who's known for education and being in the arts, and myself. And I said, one of these things is not like the other. So I summarized the European Space Agency guy, and I summarized the World Bank guy, and Prince Edward had mentioned that his father supports a program in Great Britain to promote the fact that education should be fun. So we were in concert with each other, and I asked the group to stand up and do some laughter activities, and I noticed the prince stood up and got a partner and was doing the laughter activities as well. We finished up, and he came by and said, it was indeed very funny, and I flashed back to his great-grandmother perhaps saying, we are not amused, and him saying, we were amused. So I felt like we'd come full circle. And then I flash back to earlier this year, I was doing the workshop for a group of special ed teachers in Maryland, just outside of D.C., and a woman came up and said midway through, weren't you at The Hague? And I said, yes, I was. It was a curious presentation. I said, out of the four people there, I felt like I really didn't belong. And I mentioned the four speakers, and she said, you know, you're the only one I remember. And I thought that was a real testament to humor and laughter and its power and the fact that we got people up to do some exercise and made it kinesthetic, that it had a memory for her that exceeded those other prestigious speakers and captured her in a way that that she remembered it. So I thought, well, that's a great testament to keep doing this work because it has lasting effects.
That's amazing. You need to stay on top of education issues to keep your routines relevant. Given everything that's going on in education, are you glad you're not in the classroom anymore, or do you sometimes wish you were in front of 30 kids teaching English?
You know, I thought I would miss it, but I've really enjoyed teaching teachers, you know, not only getting to do the comedy show, but the workshops with them. I'm a big fan of teachers, and a lot of my colleagues and buddies are teachers, and I'm in such awe of what they do. Your instinct is right there with all the changes. I'm not sure that I'd want to be facing all that comes their way these days, but I sure want to be in a place where we can support them and hopefully bring a little humor to the seriousness of it all.
Current Statesman talking with Jim Winters, who's the head of the educational entertainment troupe Wavelength. They appear in the Lansing School District here today. Thank you, Jim.
Thanks, Mark.
This year marks the 200th anniversary of Jane Austen's classic novel Pride and Prejudice. Current State's book reviewer Scott Southard offers a passionate plea for what he calls one of the greatest novels ever written.
Samuel Clemens, a.k.a. Mark Twain, once wrote, "Every time I read Pride and Prejudice, I want to dig her up and beat her over the skull with her own shinbone." The her in that sentence is, of course, Jane Austen, and this wasn't the only time he complained about Miss Austen. Here's another gem. It seems a great pity that they allowed her to die a natural death. Now, I don't normally disagree with Mr. Clemens, but here I have to take an exception. This year, Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice celebrates its 200th anniversary, and it's almost strange to think of it being that old, since it is a book that has never left us. Her characters, the witty Liz Bennet, the hard Mr. Darcy, had never even been given a chance to collect dust. We won't let them rest. Some of us are not even satisfied with just the tale given to us. As author after author tries to reimagine the story, maybe create a sequel, have her heroes solve a murder mystery, or even battle zombies. The less said about the zombies, the better. Jane Austen's masterpiece has conquered stage, screen, and television. But in the world of literature, Pride and Prejudice is our Mona Lisa, our Statue of David. So when I'm faced with another reinvention of this classic or a continuation, it honestly always feels a little like drawing Mickey Mouse ears on a Picasso. I understand the desire to want to keep the characters alive, the story fresh and continuing. Ending a great book like this can be as difficult as saying goodbye to an ailing friend. But all good things have an ending, and Jane never saw fit to continue the adventure. What right do we have? other than our own selfish desire to keep them close. I discovered Jane Austen's writing while at Aquinas College, thanks to an English class masterfully run by Dr. Brent Chesley. He is passionate about Pride and Prejudice, and he wanted every English student to understand without a doubt why he considered it the greatest novel written in English. That class inspired me not only to read her other books and research her life, but also to write a novel. My book, titled A Jane Austen Daydream, was my attempt to recreate her life as a work of fiction, something more like her books, giving her maybe the adventures she wished she had as compared to just rehashing the sad reality that she died young without her own Mr. Darcy. Pride and Prejudice, in my opinion, is one of the few perfect works in literature. From its flawless character development and descriptions, witty and playful dialogue, and wonderfully paced plot, it is a book to be treasured and analyzed carefully by readers and writers. For those new to the classic, the Bennet family is in a sticky situation. Mr. Bennet has only had daughters, and based on the laws of that time, if he were to die, his estates would go to a male cousin, not to his wife and children. So, for the sake of his daughters and their future, husbands have to be found, and his wife would do anything to make that happen. With the arrival of a wealthy bachelor in the region, Mr. Bingley, it is there that our story begins. Yes, even after all these years and adaptations, I still hesitate to spoil the rest of the story here. So on this anniversary, I have one suggestion for readers. Turn off the TV, put down the Bridget Jones books and Regency novels, and pick up the original, the one Jane gifted us with 200 years ago. Oh, and one last thing. I'm a little suspicious of Mark Twain's disgust for this classic. Most of these gleefully evil quotes were in letters to writers, which makes me wonder if this was part of a routine he used when in a room with fellow authors. Stir a deliciously scandalous debate. It sounds like something Sam Clemens would derive great pleasure from. Yet, when I look at that first quote above, two words stick out every time I read Pride and Prejudice. Quote, every time. Exactly how many times have you read Pride and Prejudice, Sam? For Current State, I am Scott Southard.
Today, Scott has another essay posted online about Austen's classic, along with a chance to win a signed copy of his novel, A Jane Austen Daydream. This is part of the annual online event dubbed Austen in August. You can find more details and immerse yourself in all things Pride and Prejudice at the website roofbeamreader.com. That's roofbeamreader.com. Scott's writing on a variety of topics can also be found online at sdsouthard.com. His blog is called The Musings and Artful Blunders of Scott D. Southard. It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Michigan railroads employ thousands of workers, maintain thousands of miles of track, move millions of tons of freight, and generate billions of dollars. The system's health is crucial to commerce in the state. This week, railroad officials and experts gathered for a conference in Lansing. Current State Scott Pohl went to the conference to talk with David Kloss, a professor of business administration in the Department of Supply Chain Management at MSU's Broad College of Business, about the challenges facing the state's rail system.
There's really two different railroad industries in the state. One of them is heavily agriculture, and it's moving agricultural commodities primarily out of the state, or to processing and then out of the state. For that particular industry, it is absolutely critical to have a solid railroad industry because is the only way you can effectively ship many of the products. The alternative of shipping by truck is not really viable from a cost point of view and a volume point of view. The trucks it would require to move a train load of grain is just inconceivable. So that's part of it. The second part of the railroad industry in the state is the bringing in raw material components for the automotive industry. And in that case, many of them are containers. You got a combination of moving frames and chassis and the bigger components at a carload quantity, and then you got the smaller pieces. because many of the primary rail lines go east and west in the U.S., they bypass Michigan, with the exception of moving from Chicago up through Port Huron or Detroit. And so you've got two other different a different combination of railroads. You got the Class One railroads, which are the big railroads, and they pretty much ignore the rest of Michigan, other than the big lanes. And then you've got the short line railroads, which are the ones that deliver and bring commodities to the smaller cities and towns around Michigan.
Have those smaller railroads in Michigan faced bigger challenges than the big companies then, because of their size and because of connectivity issues?
In a way they have, and in a way they're advantaged. They have faced some of the challenges because of their smaller sizes. They don't have the capital structure to invest in infrastructure, invest in equipment. At the same time, they're incredibly more flexible. They're very entrepreneurial. Some of the smaller railroads may only have 10 to 20 employees, and they're typically not unionized, so they have a whole lot of flexibility in terms of what they can do. The challenge they face is interfacing to the Class 1s, getting the access to move their cars onto the Class 1 tracks and get that interchange. And the Class 1s, while supportive, are not really, they don't view it as their primary responsibility to do it. So, and Class 1s, at least at this point, are heavily focused on large shippers. They want to deal with people that have a large number of carloads, and that's their primary focus. So interfacing with a short line railroad that has, you know, 5 to 10 cars doesn't get real excited and doesn't get a lot of interest.
What can you give me as examples of these smaller operations that might be in this area, perhaps, that people see their trains, and whether there's service in northern Michigan, even the UP? Are there shortages of rail services in some parts of Michigan?
There are definitely shortage of rail services, particularly in the northern part of the state. The panel we were just on with Lake State Railways, the Blissfield and Adrian Railway is a major one around here that has the tracks in Charlotte and Adrian and up through Lansing. So a lot of the tracks that used to be Conrail or Norfolk Southern or CSX are now one of these short line railroads that's really run very effectively by an entrepreneur. And he's growing. He provides good service. And it's a good service for the shippers around this region of the state.
Are there things that the railroad industry in Michigan needs to do to be to remain competitive or become more competitive against the alternatives like trucking?
I don't think the trucking is necessarily an alternative. I mean, certainly it is, you know, on an individual shipment basis. But given the volumes that we're having to move, the combination of the fuel costs related to trucking and the driver shortage is putting a lot of interest at shifting volumes to rail. And when you're dealing with the agricultural products, there's just simply no choice. You've got to make that shift. The critical parts for the railroad industry in the state, I think, is to come up with ways to aggregate products in the state as an alternative to aggregating them in Chicago or aggregating them in Ohio or Indiana, for that matter. But Chicago and Ohio are the two major ones. So intermodal hubs where agricultural product could be brought in a truck, possibly processed, but then loaded on a train to get out. And the same thing in the southeast part of the state. Right now we have four intermodal hubs, and we recently had a workshop with some of the automotive companies, some of the shippers out of Detroit, and said the solution is not four small intermodal hubs, it's one big one. And, you know, starting to realize to put that investment in infrastructure is really the way to go, instead of discussing ways to make the existing infrastructure work.
When you consider the industries that use railways, what do they need to do to better make use of the railways that we have in Michigan? Are there things Michigan industry can do to take better advantage of the rail system we have?
The big challenge in using the rails has always been uncertainty, delivery uncertainty. And when there's delivery uncertainty, it usually translates into more inventories, delays, or shutting down plants, and that's just become prohibitive in today's infrastructure, or today's industry. And we see this in a broader sense in terms of supply chain, that companies have sort of designed their supply chains assuming maybe a lot of the all the transport movements or the movements on lanes and transportation take 5 days on average. The shift in the railway industry is you need to understand which lanes take 5 days and make sure you get at least some of the critical ones so that they operate on time. You know, so you target specific lanes and say these are the ones we're going to focus on and what do we need to do to make those reliable. And those hopefully are the high volume ones. So you don't try to solve the whole problem, you try to solve the problem by focusing on key components and identifying ways to get those to be reliable.
David Close is an expert in supply chain management at Michigan State University. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Scott. Thanks for the opportunity.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
In case you missed it, the world came to an end in June, and then it ended again in July and once more here in August. At least, it ended in theaters. As the summer comes to a close, so do this season's apocalyptic films. Current State contributor, MSU professor and filmmaker Jeffrey Ray offers this commentary on the end of the world through cinema.
End of the world stories were among this summer's crop of films, and most quickly went away. Seth Rogen, along with his bromantic sidekicks, party during the apocalypse in This Is the End.
What the f***?
Will Smith and son Jaden bond and fight for survival in After Earth.
You did your best.
You have nothing more to prove. Now return to the ship.
And Brad Pitt remains great looking while taking on zombies in World War Z.
Declared martial law.
Daddy, what's martial law?
The question is, why such movies now? Can films be read like tea leaves or fossilized bones? Are they stealth clues of the period? Or hard indicators of collective angst of our time or of any time?
Stop! Will you tell these fools I'm not crazy? Make them listen to me before it's too late! Listen to me.
The 1956 film, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, is set in post-war America. In a normal American town, exact alien replicants hatched out of pods and replaced their human counterparts, taking over the world, one soul at a time. The national push then was for conformity, a return to pre-war normal.
Suddenly, while you're asleep, they'll absorb your minds, your memories, and you're reborn into an untroubled world.
Where everyone's the same?
Exactly.
Many an editorial or commentary from that time spoke of an America and a world that had lost its way, perhaps reaching its end.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
The 1968 film Night of the Living Dead served as a dark allegory for the tensions of an American society in great flux. Director George Romero created a low-budget horror classic, a chilling tale in which the fully living are under threat by a growing army of flesh-eating, soulless undead.
So, at this point, there is no really authentic way for us to say who or what to look for and guard yourself against. Misshapen monsters.
But the greatest asset of the story was that it seemed to capture the uncertainty of the times. What was the origin of this undead plague? Where did they come from? How could they be stopped? At the end, no hero, no knight in shining armor came to the rescue. The film fades to black with that queasy uncertainty intact. The generation that came of age then flocked to see Night of the Living Dead, seeming to embrace such uncertainty. Nowadays, zombies are in the news more than nuclear annihilation. But that was not the case in 1983, when the TV movie The Day After drew a record audience of 100 million viewers. The Day After was the story of a nuclear bombing and the pandemonium that followed. As it was broadcast, counselors at a 1-800 hotline were standing by. In fact, President Reagan watched the film a few days before the broadcast and wrote in his diary that it was, quote, very effective and left me greatly depressed.
Hello? Is anybody there? Anybody at all?
The Day After was perhaps a rare moment when a TV program captured a national mood. Pods under the bed and flesh-eating zombies might represent an existential angst. But in the early 1980s, nuclear annihilation was seen as a very real possibility. Perhaps these films are markers of the times, but an end-of-the-world theme is also just plain irresistible. Action, impending doom, and maybe one last kiss before it all comes crashing down. Do sell popcorn. And a world suddenly saved by Brad Pitt or Will Smith is a great final act. This summer's end-of-the-world films may not be great art or social commentary, but such films have proven time and again to be memorable box office hits. Just not this summer. For Current State, I'm Jeffrey Ray.
And Jeffrey is an MSU professor and filmmaker. Listen for more of Jeffrey's thoughts on film here on Current State. That's our show. Tomorrow on Current State, we'll be broadcasting live near the Cowles House at 6 p.m. ahead of the Spartan football season opener at Spartan Stadium with Western Michigan University. It'll be a joint broadcast with Current Sports host Al Martin. If you're nearby, stop over and say hi. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our show's producer. Thanks as well to Emmanuel Berry, to Aaron Young for engineering, and to Gabriella Saldivia for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.